está bien.
Ezekiel, we've been doing chapters 6 through 12 this morning. Chapter 6, we'll begin with verses 1 through 7. The message to the mountains. Why to the mountains? Why a message to the mountains from God to Ezekiel? Because the whole land, that is the mountains, the hills, and the valleys, particularly the mountains and hills, were filled or dotted and pockmarked with altars and shrines to false gods. Israel had desecrated the true temple of God which was built in Jerusalem and had instead popularized false shrines dotting the countryside, which had become a stench and abomination to God. They had even gone so debased as to offer their children on idol altars. Therefore, the Lord said that those same idol altars would be desecrated with the putrefying corpses of the worshippers themselves when the enemy or Babylon would come to overthrow them. Then they would know that the Lord was indeed God. And here there was a danger of syncretism. We mentioned this in the first few chapters, syncretism. Syncretism is the fusing together of elements of foreign religions with the true religion and handing that down generationally. Verses 8 through 10 of chapter 6. Here Israel was going to be caused to remember. When horrifying conditions were to come upon the remnant in exile, they would then remember and admit that the Lord was God because of the desecration of their idol altars, worshipping these abominations in the mountains, and the desolation of their land. Because of the desecration of those altars with the corpses of those slain who worshipped, and the desolation of their land, they would then know that the Lord was God. Verses 11 through 14 call this the dance of death. Here there's some more dramatic action. Ezekiel is instructed by God to clap his hands and stamp his feet while he was expressing or sharing this last pronouncement of doom. Ezekiel, it's such a terrible message of doom that he cannot merely stand dispassionately by and proclaim and declare this terrible judgment. His entire body is jerked into agitated action as he claps his hands, stamps his feet, and speaks. The judgment of God, in a very real sense, is of human making. God was not some ogre pouring out his wrath upon these people. They had brought the judgment of God upon themselves by the sin of syncretism, fusing elements of foreign religions with that of the true religion and handing it down generationally, worshipping God in idol altars, in the mountainside, in the hillside, sacrificing their children on those altars. Syncretism. The Apostle Paul shares in the New Testament, "What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound?" And to use that as a stepping stool for this statement, if we continue in sin, grace can no longer abound. And here the wrath and the judgment of God was about to fall. Moving on to chapter 7, the entire chapter, verses 1 through 27. The tempest of destruction. Ezekiel sees, and he is describing as if, this was so similar, as though it was a meteorologist observing and commenting on a cyclonic storm approaching, wreaking havoc as it comes. But yet, Israel turns to human resources for help instead of to God. Some thoughts. Number one, pride and pomposity in the hearts of the children of Israel. There was in their hearts a desire for preeminence, and God had warned them already in Deuteronomy 8:17, where he had spoken to Israel and said, "Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth." Friends, what we are and what we have and have become are the gift and grace of God. In fact, the more we are blessed, the more our hearts should be filled with gratitude to God and not pride in our hearts. Second thought, they were filled with self-confidence. when there was a danger of a threat on their nation, they would blow the trumpet and the army would be summoned, and then they would be safe and be able to thwart the attack of the enemy. But in Exodus 15:3, now listen to this, it says that the Lord himself was their true warrior. So in this case, there would be no point in them blowing the trumpet, because who was their true warrior? It was God. And he wasn't going to respond. In fact, he was their opponent now. He was going to bring his wrath upon them. So blowing the trumpet in this case, it is God who fought that battle for them. It's God who fights our battles for us. And he was not on their side this time. So their sin of self-confidence. Thirdly, their confidence was in their wealth. We're reading this passage in chapter 7 about their silver and their gold. So their confidence was in their wealth, in the power that wealth gave them, in the influence that wealth brought them, in the security of their riches. And in this chapter we read that their silver and gold would be cast into the streets like slop being thrown into a sewage ditch. Wealth itself, by the way, is not being criticized by the Lord through Ezekiel, but it is the dependence on that wealth that the children of Israel were being taught about and challenged about. In verse 20, a fourth thought, there's a phrase there. It says that their beautiful ornament would be destroyed. The temple in Jerusalem is that beautiful ornament that the prophet is talking about. That beautiful ornament that was to be destroyed was the temple in Jerusalem. But friends, there was something much deeper than that. The true ornament was the presence of God in that temple. And even as the physical temple was to be destroyed, the presence of God, the true temple, was going to be lifted up and removed from that temple. And that was much more grave and sad. Chapter 8, verses 1 through 6. This is again a vision of Jerusalem that Ezekiel has. He's sitting in his house with the leaders of the exiles, and he has this vision 14 months later. You recall from the first few chapters, he lay on one side for 390 days, and the right side and the left side, or the left side for 390, the right side for 40 days. To show how many years, the date for each year, the judgment of God against Israel and Judah respectively, and that 430 days was a little over 14 months. So now, we come to chapter 8, he has a vision again of Jerusalem, and this is about 14 months later in his house, and he's sitting with some leaders of the exiles. And it is a powerful vision. A divine being takes Ezekiel up by a lock of his hair, and he is whisked away in the spirit. Last week we used the word teleported. He is transported from one place to the other in his spirit to Jerusalem. And he finds himself in the temple at Jerusalem, in the outer court of the temple at the north entrance. And the north entrance was that through which the kings and the royal family entered the temple. And at this north entrance, God shows Ezekiel, he says, "Look, son of man," and Ezekiel sees an image of jealousy. More precisely, an image of lust. The Canaanite goddess of love named Asherah. Some thoughts. You cannot mix the glory of God with an abomination. You cannot mix the glory of the God of Israel with an abominable idol. Either you remove the false presence and have the true presence of God stay. If not, if we don't remove the false presence, the true presence of God will depart. Second thought. By having this idol of the Canaanite goddess Asherah in the temple, the leaders of Israel, royalty and the priests, had broken the first commandment, Exodus 20, "I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other gods before me." They had broken the first commandment, and when you break the first commandment, they had automatically undermined all the other nine commandments. and it would lead directly to moral decadence and destruction. Third thought, there's a feeling of profound pathos, of deep divine grief from the heart of God. Profound pathos. God, his anger was going to be roused at this abominable act of putting this idol right there in his temple. But for the moment, his grief, his heart is broken, and he shows Ezekiel, look at this abomination that they have placed in my temple, where my presence and glory is supposed to reside. And that grief comes through from the heart of God. In verse 6 of chapter 8, God says to Ezekiel, son of man, look at them. They drive me far from my own sanctuary. They drive me far from my own sanctuary. They are literally pushing me out of my temple. God, so far in the Old Testament, dwelt in a temple of wood and stone. Today, folk, he dwells in temples of flesh and blood. And I believe the challenge to us is, son of man, brother, sister in Christ, what's the heart of God? Are we hearing him say, you're pushing me, you're forcing me out of that temple of flesh and blood, which was created for me to dwell in? And God's heart is broken as he tells Ezekiel, son of man, they are driving me far from my sanctuary. They're driving me far from my own sanctuary. Chapter 8, we continue verses 7 through 13. The art of idolatry. Here Ezekiel is led to the inner court. And in verses 7 and 8 we read, now remember, he's led to the inner court by God in this vision. And in verse 7 and 8 it says that he saw a hole in the wall and he was asked to dig. A better rendition of that would be that he is told, son of man, examine the wall closely. And he says, Ezekiel says, when I looked, behold, or lo, a door. I saw a door. In other words, in the inner court of the sanctuary of the temple in Jerusalem, Ezekiel is able to detect a door only under close scrutiny. If it wasn't looked at and observed carefully, he would not have observed this door. Folks, this is talking about the secret chambers of our heart. That a fellow brother or a sister or a minister, the pastor may not see, but God sees. The prophet did not see it readily. God saw. He knew it. He said, son of man, I take you to the inner chamber. Look closely. What do you see? And Ezekiel says, yes, I see a door. Now follow what happens inside that door. Ezekiel enters that secret room in the inner court of the temple, and he is shocked to see on the walls of this room murals and paintings of reptiles, vermin, and unclean animals on the walls. It's not artwork that God and his prophet are now coming against, but it is the art of idolatry that has stunned the prophet. And he sees in that vision 70 leading citizens of Israel worshipping these inanimate murals. And Ezekiel recognizes two of those leaders. One of them was Shaphan and the other was Jaazaniah, both men of distinction in Israel. Now listen to the statement. In the secret place, in their hearts, to all outward intents and purposes to Israel, they were supposedly worshiping God in his temple. But in their hearts, in the secret place, in the inner court of the temple, they had fallen. In their secret place, in their hearts, which could not be observed by humans, they had fallen, but God saw. And while I was meditating on that, I was wondering, does that sound familiar today with ministries and ministers at times? That in their heart, in their secret places, they have fallen. There's some irony in this. these leading men of Israel, 70 of them, were trying to keep this a secret. But you can't hide anything from God's folk. Thought number one, these leaders were actively pursuing evil. Here's a thought from Confucius. He said, if a ruler himself is upright, all will go well, even without orders. He said, if a ruler himself is upright, is righteous, all will go well, even without him giving orders. But then the converse is true. If a ruler is corrupt and unjust, all will not be well, and the people would not even desire to obey him, even if he gave the orders. What hope then was there for Jerusalem? We've just studied and read that the 70 leading people were in their hearts worshipping these murals and pictures and abominations in the temple. Since the leadership of Jerusalem had fallen, the future of Jerusalem now depended on the exiles. Another thought, in desperation to make it happen. Now these were leaders of Israel. The Jews always were, have been, and are a very strong, nationalistic-minded people. It may be that perhaps in desperation, they were turning, maybe they'd given up on the God of Israel, saying, how long till you deliver us? In desperation, they may have turned to these idol gods, to these murals, to these paintings, to these reptiles, and worshipping them in desperation, somehow trying to make this happen, to bring about their deliverance from the oppression of Babylon. Trying to make this happen and striving in the flesh. Here's the tragedy and the irony of this. The God of Israel it was who brought them out of Egyptian slavery. And now of all places, they turn to the gods of Egypt to deliver them from Babylonian slavery. I repeat that. It was the God of Israel who had brought them out from Egyptian slavery, and now of all places they return to the gods of Egypt to help them and deliver them out from Babylonian slavery. And thirdly, there's the delusion of secrecy. They thought this was a secret, but there are no secrets from God. To act so, as if you could keep a secret from God, is the height of folly, or folly of the first order. Continuing with chapter 8, verses 14 through 28. There were two more sacrilegious scenes that Ezekiel sees. And the Lord keeps telling him, son of man, you've seen this abomination? To paraphrase what the Lord is telling Ezekiel is, you ain't seen nothing yet. There's even worse abominations. Follow me in the vision and I will show you. And here's two more scenes. The first sacrilegious scene that he saw was that of sacral weeping. There were some women who were worshipping the Babylonian god named Tammuz. He was the god of, supposedly, fertility and the underworld. Fertility in the sense of harvest and crops, that it was him who gave them a good harvest, and then he died after harvest time. And so here were these women crying and pleading to Tammuz to come back to life the following spring so they would have more crops again. And this was not just a superficial weeping, but a weeping from inside. And these tears that were shedding to this god Tammuz was to bring him back to life. What an ironic thought. Our God quickens us, brings us to life spiritually and eternally. They were praying to bring their God back to life. And Ezekiel watches these women weeping, shedding their tears. This Tammuz of Babylon is similar to Baal, to the god Baal in Palestine and Osiris of Egypt. Tammuz was a dying god. Jehovah God, the God of Israel, is a living God. What a waste of the tears of these women. And the other scene that Ezekiel saw was that of sun worship. He sees in the next scene 25 men facing the east, looking to the morning sunlight and sunshine in the hope that that would dispel their gloom. And we've seen now four different scenes, and they involve all of Israel. The first one, quickly to recap, was the image of Asherah, of lust, of jealousy, which was that that the people were involved in, and it was from the origin of Canaan. The second was that of the secret room with the murals and the walls. The national leaders were involved in that, and it was from the origin of Egypt. Third was that of the weeping women, which demonstrated their loss of faith in the God of Israel, worshipping Tammuz, Babylon's God. And fourthly was that of sun worship by priests, 25 of them, and sun worship is common in many Eastern religions. You see again the word syncretism, taking elements, fusing elements of foreign religions with the true religion and handing it down generationally. And so we see from these four scenes that if there was any hope for Jerusalem, it was going to have to be with the exiles, because the inhabitants of Jerusalem had gone astray. There's two thoughts before we close chapter 8 out. And that is the focus of this vision in chapter 8, in these four scenes, is the failure of true worship. In each case, they were worshipping pagan gods from other religions. The focus of this vision is the failure of true worship. Folk, we are summoned to worship God. Let's put it a different way. We were created to worship God. We were created for His pleasure. We are summoned to worship God. Failure to do so. We are summoned to worship God. Not to do so, or to do so wrongly, is to miss the very purpose of our existence. I mean, we are summoned to worship God. Or to do so wrongly is to miss the very purpose of our existence. Failure to worship God in truth leads to total moral. Without true worship of the one true God, total moral deterioration sets in and takes place. Total moral degeneration. Chapter 9, slaughter in the city. Here again, a terrible judgment of God upon Jerusalem. It's interesting to see that judgment begins at the house of God. That's right. It begins in the temple and then out onto the streets of the city. Judgment begins at the house of God. There are six divine executioners that are summoned. Obviously divine beings summoned by God, and each of them come like a small elite squadron, with each of them with their weapons of destruction. But for the seventh man with them, clothed in linen, with a writing case along with him, an interesting individual. We would probably call the seventh man the squadron leader, the leader of that elite squad, God squad. The seventh man is instructed, the one in linen with the writing case, is instructed by God to mark the foreheads of everyone in the city of Jerusalem who, to use an Old Testament phrase, have not bowed the knee to Baal, who are still righteous, who still serve Jehovah God, the God of Israel. God always has a remnant. Even though the priests, the leaders of the nation and the people had fallen into syncretism, into idol worship, into these abominations, into mule worship, into sun worship, into Tammuz worship, there's a remnant that did not. And the seventh man with the linen and the writing, white linen and wearing white linen in the writing case is instructed by God, go to the city first before the other six who have the weapons of destruction, and you mark those people out who are righteous. And then God instructs, and then you other six, destroy everybody in the city, man, boy, woman, girl, or child, who does not have the mark. And all the unmarked are executed. It's done, they come back, and the seventh man reports it to God. Some thoughts. Firstly, this is rather similar to the plague, the tenth plague in Egypt, where the firstborn son was killed and the blood wasn't sprinkled on the doorpost. The difference is that that slaughter symbolized liberation and the birth of a nation, but this slaughter symbolized the end or the potential death of a nation. What began centuries ago in love, where Abraham was God called about, then Isaac and Jacob, what began centuries ago in love was about to end in the wrath of God. It was about to end in wrath. Second thought about this. A prophet. Some of us think a prophet is somebody who says, thus saith the Lord, and is constantly pronouncing judgments and prophecies and articles of doom. But what's the true heart or the heart of a true prophet of God? A prophet is not a mere megaphone who is amplifying the word of the Lord to the people. That is part of his responsibility, but that's not all that he is. Notice with Ezekiel the prophet, in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 9, when Ezekiel hears what's going to happen, and this squad of seven, the six with the destruction weapons followed the seventh man of linen, are leaving, Ezekiel cries out. He says, I fell on my face and cried and said, Our Lord God, wilt thou destroy all that remains? A spontaneous intercession rising up from the heart of the prophet, flowing forth from his heart, which is rooted in compassion. See the other side of the prophet. The third point to note here is the seventh man, and this is interesting for some scholars, the seventh man wearing linen with a writing case, he is to place a mark on the forehead of those which were righteous, the remnant in the city of Jerusalem. Now follow this closely. The Hebrew word for mark in our Bible, to place a mark, is the word taw, T-A-W, taw. And taw is the last letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It's like Z or Z in English and Omega in Greek. Taw is the mark to be placed. And how is taw written in the Hebrew alphabet? It's in a shape of a slanting cross, or our English capital or uppercase letter X. That's the way taw is written in Hebrew, the Latin of the alphabet. Now, what's this? Revelation 14:1, John the Revelator says that the faithful had the names of God and the Lamb on their foreheads, and follow this fence, in Greek, the first letter for the spelling of the word Christ in Greek is the letter X. And that's what it was originally written in Greek. Just thought I'd point that out. Moving on to chapter 10, verses 1 through 8, there's a scattering of burning coals. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 8, the scattering of burning coals. The key figures here are God, the cherubim, and the seventh man. But now he has set aside his writing case. It's almost as if he uses writing case to write the names down of those that were the remnant. So he's done with that function for now. He sets it aside. The man, the seventh man, is now told and instructed by God to go below the throne to where the cherubim were with the endlessly spinning wheels, and right there one cherub or cherubim takes some live burning coals, a handful, and hands them to the seventh man. He then is to go and scatter these burning coals of God over the evil city of Jerusalem. Some thoughts on this. Number one, the judgment of God cannot be distinguished from the glory of God. I repeat, the judgment of God cannot be distinguished or separated from the glory of God. The same coals that are scattered over Jerusalem to destroy evil and consume evil were part of the glory of the entourage of God. The burning coals were part of his scintillating glory, but they are the same coals that are used to destroy impurity. The book of Ezekiel is pregnant with the theme of purity and punishment. God's burning coals may either purify and heal, as in Isaiah's case in chapter 6 of Isaiah, or they can consume, as in the case of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. And here's a thought. One need not fear the burning coals of God unless one were no longer holy. One need not fear the burning coals of God unless one were no longer holy or persistently living in sin. The second thought is that the judgment of God marked his departure. Please flip the tape over for the continuation of Ezekiel chapter 10 and on to chapters 11 and 12. Thank you. Continuing with that second thought, we said that the judgment of God marked his departure. In verse 6, we read about the whirling wheels. Clearly there is movement here of the chariot throne of God, which is even more ominous than his judgment. For the judgment of a God who is present, however terrible that judgment may be, is preferable to the absence of God. Repeat, the judgment of a God who is present, however terrible that judgment may be, is better, preferable than the absence of God. Chapter 10, verses 9 through 22, the vision of the plain renewed. This is more repetitive of God's vision, which is repetitive, it seems, of God's chariot throne. In the beginning of chapter 10, it seemed to be moving towards the climax of that of God moving or getting prepared to move out of the temple. But now here, from verses 9 through 22 of chapter 10, there's a lengthy description which seems to delay that climax and helps to build tension, perhaps a good literary device or a technique by the writer, by the prophet. Moving to chapter 11, verses 1 through 13. The title was Death at the Temple Gate. Ezekiel sees here in the vision 25 men meeting together. We're not sure what the agenda was, but he recognizes two of them, Jaazaniah and Pelatiah. Both of these were dignitaries, ministers of state. In verse 3, we read, is it not time to build yet, but a rendition from the Septuagint? The short form is LXX in Roman numerals, meaning 70, because the Septuagint is the original Greek translation from the first Greek translation from the original Hebrew. The Septuagint renders that phrase this way, from verse 3 of chapter 11. Have not the houses been built recently? In other words, this meeting of these 25 men is self-congratulatory. They're reviewing their building program, or something like a housing and works program. Since the initial invasion of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, they've been rebuilding the city, and they get together and say, haven't we done a great job? Have not the houses been built recently? And in verse 3, the second half, 3b, they quote a statement, a proverb, the city is the cauldron, and we are the flesh. They call Jerusalem the city of the cauldron, and they are the substance of that city of the flesh. They are appointed themselves as the influential ones who made this rebuilding possible. And God, through Ezekiel, reverses that pompous proverb, because the prophet now states, yes, the city is the cauldron, but it is the slain, or the corpses of the inhabitants of the city, that is the meat or the flesh. The problem with the Council of 25, or these elders, was that they had been busy passing bylaws of the city, but they had forgotten or neglected the bylaws of God. And even as Ezekiel speaks, Pelatiah, one of the two that he recognized in the group of 25, drops dead. Pelatiah drops dead. Why? What's the problem here? This group of elders or leaders had rebuilt the city. They were attending or taking care of the surface problem. But they never stopped to ask the question, why were we invaded by Babylon? Why did that desolation and destruction come upon us in the first place? So they never got at the bottom of the root of the problem, the sin of syncretism, abominations, worshipping idols, forsaking the true God of Israel, and they were just doing a surface job. And Pelatiah drops dead. So they were taking care of the surface level problem, rebuilding the city, did not deal with the root cause. But folks, such blindness is not uncommon. Too many times in our own lives, we take care of the surface problems, outward physical manifestations, when oftentimes there's a deep spiritual root. Moving on to chapter 11, verses 14 through 25. And here there's a mission for those in exile. A message and a mission for the exiles. I want here with chapter 11 to read to us verses 16 through 20. They're a beautiful passage of precious promises of God. God is saying to Ezekiel, therefore say, thus saith the Lord God, although I have cast them afar off from among the heathen, these are the exiles, and all yet, although I have scattered them among the countries, yet will I be to them as a little sanctuary in the countries where they shall come. Therefore say, Ezekiel, thus saith the Lord, I will even gather you from the people, assemble you out of the countries where you've been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And they shall come hither, and they shall take away all the detestable things thereof, and all the abominations thereof from thence. And I will give them a new heart, and I will put a new spirit within you, and I will take the stony heart out of their flesh and give them a heart of flesh. That they may walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. Some tremendous scriptures of hope for the exiles in Ezekiel's day. Verses 19 and 20. About giving them a new heart and putting a new spirit within them, etc. I will be their God, they'll be my people, are almost identical to chapter 36, verses 26 and 27 in Ezekiel. Jerusalem's remnant, or inhabitants, had written off the exiles. They thought they were the ones to possess the city and rebuild it. But God says, though they, the exiles, be scattered, I will regather them, they will repossess the land. Right then, at that point in time during the vision, the whirling wheels, or the endlessly spinning wheels by the cherubim of the holy chariot of God, they move this holy chariot up, up and away from the temple and the holy city of Jerusalem. The presence of God is departing. Ichabod. The future of Jerusalem evidently now lay with the exiles. Before the exiles, this was a message of hope. There may well be a second Exodus. Some thoughts on this. One, in the preceding scene, recall Pelatiah, one of the 25 elders, dropped dead. When that happened, Ezekiel cried out to God for mercy. Why did he do that? What's this? In Hebrew, the name Pelatiah means the Lord causes a remnant to escape. When Ezekiel saw that Pelatiah dies, he would have looked at that as if to think that nobody was going to be left alive in Jerusalem, because even the one whose name meant God will cause a remnant to escape, that he died symbolically, meaning that not even a remnant would escape. God, you're not going to destroy all of Israel, will you? And so you see, Ezekiel cries out to God. But with this message about the exile, Ezekiel too gets fresh hope. And here's an important thought about the exile. For them, their hope lay within them, not in the empty hands of those far away in Jerusalem. These exiles were written off by the inhabitants of Jerusalem. They thought, in fact, of themselves, that they couldn't do anything. They had no material or financial possessions, but were physically frail and weak. And now they discover that they were the ones through whom God would work. God gave them. He said, I will put a new spirit in you. I'll put a new heart within you. And you will accomplish the work for which I've called you to. Folks, if we feel like those exiles, we feel that people have written us off. And you and I may feel at times we've been written off in ourselves, that we are not good, that we are worth nothing, that we have no material resources, no financial resources. God says to us, I will put a new spirit within you. I will put a new heart within you. And the work that I want to accomplish will be done through you. Yes, you. You may feel like an exile, but God says, I'm looking for you. I'm going to use you. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 16. Titled as Exiled from Those in Exile. God gives Ezekiel another practical sermon to preach to the people. He's told to prepare an exile's bag. In other words, he would have looked like a hobo or a tramp. And if he was a prophetess, we would have called him a bag lady. In the evening, he should dig a hole through the mud wall skirting the encampment of his exiles and leave them into the darkness and go into the darkness in the presence of all the exiles while they watch him. And then the exiles are left through the evening and the night to wonder about what the meaning of this practical message is all about. In the morning, Ezekiel returns. He pronounces the meaning. He acted out the previous day, and he speaks it out the following morning. As he speaks, he says, he talks about the prince of Jerusalem, and that's a reference to Zedekiah, the ruler of Jerusalem at that time. And Zedekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, this is what was going to happen to them. They would have to be forced to leave Jerusalem through its breached wall, just like he dug a hole through the wall of the mud wall of the encampment. Zedekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem would be made to leave Jerusalem through its breached wall. It would be attacked again. Some thoughts. Number one, the ministry of judgment retains hope of repentance. In verse 3c, we read in chapter 12, God said to Ezekiel, perhaps they will understand. Maybe this time somebody will understand. God desires, even through the judgment, that some might come to repentance. Secondly, by Ezekiel acting it out and leaving for the night, it left the exiles room and time to recollect, to reflect for the correct meaning of what this action of his leaving like a tramp in the evening could mean. The exiles, you know what they may have thought? Wonderful, this is good news. Maybe it's over. Ezekiel is leaving. Maybe the day is coming. We're going to have our freedom. We're going to pack up our bags and we're going to be going home. But the hopes would have been dashed to the ground in the morning when Ezekiel comes back and tells them this is a reference to what's going to happen to those in Jerusalem. We're not getting our freedom. No, not yet. There's a thought about that. We need to be wary of imposing our desires, our interpretations upon the Word of God. Third thought, the purpose of this judgment was to declare God's lordship. Judgment has a goal, that God says that they may know that I am the Lord, in verses 15 and 16. To live without the knowledge of God is to miss the whole purpose of our existence. God says they will know. In some sense, it's the same with a parent and their children. When the child is an Arab, the parents spank the child, and the child knows who their parents are and who's in control, who's the boss. And God says they will know that I am the Lord. Here's some a further thought on that. If truth cannot be learned in peace, it will be learned in judgment. But either is preferable to not learning the truth at all. Listen to that again. If truth cannot or will not be learned in peace, it will be learned in judgment. But either of those two options is better than not learning about the truth at all. Continuing in chapter 12, verses 17 through 20, dying in the twilight of doom, Ezekiel was told by God to eat bread and to drink water, quaking as in terror. And you can picture him then the next day in front of the people in public with his hands shaking, with his physical frame weak, taking this cup of water and the water spilling out the sides of his lips, taking the bread and fumbling with it at his mouth as crumbs and bits and pieces fall down the ground. And this was to demonstrate the fearful condition of Jerusalem's inhabitants. They would even be dining fearfully and trembling in the twilight of their doom. Some thoughts on this. Number one, judgment of God results, is a result of former actions of those who are being judged. It's not again the wrath of an angry God, but it's the justice of God for the previous actions of those who are being judged. There's a French lawyer and theologian named Elul who said, violence begets violence and nothing else. Violent acts are like seeds that are planted, and they bring forth a harvest of violence later. Second thought, even in times of crisis, there is no mention of fasting or prayer to abate the wrath of God by the inhabitants of Jerusalem. They continue dining in the twilight of their doom. And those who eat the bread of violence cannot also eat the bread of life. And so they must eventually eat the bread of trembling and fear of life itself. I repeat, those who eat the bread of violence cannot also eat the bread of life. And so they must eat the bread of trembling in fear of life itself. Chapter 12, the last section, verses 21 through 28, there's a reversal of some ancient proverbs here, two of them. Number one, Ezekiel's message is rebuffed. It's slapped off by the people. They have their own sayings that they use, and one of them was this: all prophecy is never fulfilled. A better way to put that is, they were saying, listen, time passes and nothing ever happens. You prophets say all of this, but time passes, nothing happens. And that implies that either the message is false or the prophet is false. Ezekiel, God through Ezekiel says, listen up. Time is up. Your time is up. And everything that I said is going to happen. Time's up and everything is going to happen. So he reverses that proverb. The second proverb of theirs was that fulfillment of these prophecies is far in the future. And that is a more cautious approach. This is like those who want their bread buttered on both sides. Those who are sitting on the fence. They're not directly coming out and saying, I don't believe you, you're lying. They're saying, well, that's going to happen so far down the line, it doesn't affect me, I don't have to worry about it. And God, through the prophet Ezekiel, is saying, it will happen now and in your time. Don't think this is for the generations down the road. It will happen now and in your time. Thirdly, note the people's blindness. Both these above proverbs, the first one says, listen, time passes, nothing happens, the fulfillment of this is far in the future. The exiles who heard this, they were themselves right then in exile. It had happened, it was happening to them right there and then. It had already happened to them, they were in exile. Now we understand better what Jesus meant when he said, eyes have they and see not, ears and hear not. Question. What's our attitude to the rapture, for example, when Jesus Christ comes for his bride? Are we of the mentality, well, it's so far down the road, I don't have to worry about it? It may happen now. in our time. The last thought, fourthly, we see the difficulty of the prophet's task. He is rebuffed, slapped off, but he never wavered. Why? Because he had an encounter with the living God. And secondly, because he stayed close to the one he served. And that's my challenge to us today. Let's stay tight and close with Jesus. Keep your eyes on Jesus. God bless you. I'll